chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are right smack dab in the middle of it.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome back to the Secret Truth for the second hour, the rebroadcast. We're rebroadcasting again the second hour of an author, David McRaney, and he's the author of You Are Not So Smart. Anyway, I just want to pick up a little bit on where I left off on my introduction for that first hour. And what I want to say is that the American public is being abused and used and manipulated. 9/11 has been the chief, you could say, tool to really begin to foment and to, to foment a national security state. You could say that a national security state would differ from what we have come away from, in that the trend is towards national police, towards a stronger national government, federal government, towards more police actions that resemble some types of military types of actions at times, the use of military equipment in police actions, and so forth. And if when I was down on the 2012 GOP in Tampa, I happened to stumble onto a meeting that was being held out there at the Florida State Fairgrounds. And the meeting was being held, it was LEO meeting, and it stood for law enforcement online. What they have going today is they have meetings all over the country. They're beginning to network policemen and teach them how to network on the web. And it's a highly classified project. If you go in there, LEO, Law Enforcement Online, you're going to see an FBI notice. Well, this is nothing to fool with. I'm bringing it to your attention because there are so many, many things like this that the public is little aware of. And at that time, in 2012, I wasn't aware of it. The way we stumbled in on it or found out about it was we were doing the web production, the video production, for Paul Festival, the Paul Festival. Robinette, Deborah Robinette out of San Diego, bless her soul, produced along with a few other friends the Paul Festival. They didn't have much help from the Paul campaign, Ron Paul's campaign at the time, but they should have, but they didn't. But anyway, we went out there to produce the video, and we did 2.5 days of very arduous video production, and it worked out pretty good. We did have people online, not the number that we needed, but it covered pretty well, just covered our expenses. But in driving into that Florida State fairgrounds, we came up, and off to the right was a sign with all capital letters, L-E-O, Leo. I thought, Leo, what does that mean? Leo the Lion? No, I don't know. We drove up there and was cleared through the security, came up to a T, and I told my driver, I said, turn to the right, I think that's it. Well, that was the wrong turn. We went down there and found out where the LEO was. And we looked out over the right, and there was a field, several football fields of cars. There must have been 300 or 400 cars out there. They were all constable, sheriffs, police cars, da-da-da-da-da. So later on, we found out, you know, where our site was, the venue within the fairgrounds, and started setting up and everything. But then I went back and I started looking at this Leo and found out it's Law Enforcement Online. The jurisdictions then, the point that I'm trying to make with this little story, is that the jurisdictions are beginning to be worked across, In other words, law enforcement has always been legal and had legal authority within certain jurisdictions that they were lawfully able to do police work in, whether they're cities and counties and states and so forth. But as far as doing networking, there was no web at the time. So you could say, you know, in some cases, criminals had a free rein, like the Bonnie and Clyde era, where they could just get on the roads and back roads and get away from a bank robbery, event that they participated in. But what today we have the Posse Comitatus, which was a law in the 1800s that prohibited the use of the military for police actions. But it looks like that is, you call in, the governor is beginning to call in the National Guard. We're seeing more disruptions of police actions. We're seeing more and more violent protests. We're seeing more and more shootings, whether they're school shootings or they're so-called jihadist shootings of individual and small groups and so forth. So we're beginning to enter a period of chaos. In pre-Nazi Germany during the Weimar Republic, the same types of events or similar events were taking place in Germany. There were groups like out there that were demonstrating and causing a lot of harm and resorting to violence. The Nazi Party actually got support because the SA was out there knocking heads for the Nazi elites. See, we're seeing groups here. We're seeing a confrontation between the left, the right, the black, the white, and so forth. All these ethnic things are beginning to, like Saul Alinsky. See, Saul Alinsky, was an organizer in Chicago, and he wrote a book, about community activism. And so, and what you do, the techniques you do is you take a small group and you start cultivating them and targeting their enemies, see. Like you might say that these people are against your rights, or they're whites and they're no good. These rednecks don't care about you, but I care about you. And we've got to organize. And we've got to go against these redneckers, these whites and all this. And so out of Alinsky came many of the Chicago radicals, see. We had a rise of radicalism during the leading up to the Vietnam War, and then you had that 1968 convention, the Democratic Convention in Chicago, where there was major rioting going on, and you had the SDS, the Students for Democratic Society, and then a splinter group off of that was the Weathermen, and the Weathermen amounted to the most radicals, like Ayers, and some of those people were the Weathermen, and Bernadine Dorn, people like that. So, and I actually, a few years ago, interviewed the lady that was a Weatherman, a member, whose townhouse in New York blew up. They were assembling a bomb in there, this Weatherman group, to be used out at a USO dance out there in New York at one of those army posts there, I believe. It got real radical back then, see. Then it sort of cooled down. They sort of assimilated back into normal society. But it looks like today, after 9/11 especially, we're beginning to see a rise of more chaos than we had before. And the groups are being pitted against each other. And like I was saying, it's the Democrats against the Republicans, the left against the right, the whites against the blacks, and so forth. And this, we need to try to overcome these divisions. But the hate and resentment is the way that we're all managed by these so-called leaders. So when you say leaders, you have to say groups. If you say groups, you have to say cults. And what actually has materializes out here in our society is that organized groups are cultic by degree. Some types of organized groups you can walk in out of, like a church that does not do evil out there. And then there are other groups that they'll physically restrain, you see. And so that would be a cult that's a very, very, dangerous by imprisoning you and physically, you know, restricting your movements. The technique that many of these cults use, and I've studied some of this over the years, and Stephen Hassan wrote a book, Cult Awareness, was his network up in Chicago. And anyway, he's up in Massachusetts practicing psychological rehabilitation and counseling, I believe. But anyway, Steve Hassan broke through. He was part of the Unification Church, and his parents hired a deprogrammer, and they went in and deprogrammed and pulled him out of that. But the groups don't necessarily always have to be a religious group, see, but it helps to recruit people. They can always talk about Jesus, and they can even have the Bible, but there's always a different angle there or something. But anyway, many of these cults use what they call love bombing, okay? And what that technique basically does or is that they'll take a prospective new member. They'll take them out to a coffee shop or invite them to a party, and several of the members will start what they call love bombing, telling that individual how smart they are and how much they would be an addition to their group. And boy, we could really use your brains, and you're very deeply informed about this. That would really help us a lot. And these are the types of techniques that they use called love bombing. See, so all of these techniques are used by, and other techniques are used as they recruit people more and more into these cults and to these organizations, then there's less love bombing and the rules become stricter. See? And the rules are stricter because they're used to control the individual. So, and nobody has the final answer except the great guru that is the top leader. See what I mean? And that's the way that they control. There's always some big leader at the top of the food chain that's going to give us the final answer. Many of these cults have very, very convoluted and complicated systems of philosophical religiosity and psychological and you could say mechanisms of thinking and ideas based teachings. Okay, the teachings that they promulgate can get to be very overwhelming to a new, initiate, you could say. And so the only person that they always say, they always look to is a top guy. He could be, in the Indian hustles, we call them gurus, see. And there again, you can have Indian hustles too. These guys sitting over there as great gurus, they're hustling their members too, see. Just because they wear whites and all that and prayed around like they're highly enlightened doesn't mean they are. See, that's the ruse. See, the ruse that they hide behind is that they are wealthy and very much so enlightened. See, this Mac Rainey fella that it was on the first hour and that's coming up on the second hour. The reason why I'm putting this up again is that he has some answers. See, is that we always think that we're really smart. We're not so smart, you know, as we think we are. And that's what he talks about, and that's what Charlotte and I engaged him in, was the discussion that we began to have was something that is right along the lines of my thinking. And my thinking is real, real simple. I've actually boiled it down into very simple terms, even in relationship to David McRaney's ideas, see. And my ideas about what I call delusion is that at birth, we're born into a family and we're captured by that family. So we're subject to conditioning and programming and the teachings that come from that family. But that family had been subject to the worldly conditioning state for their parents and their families. And so these teachings in most cases tend to be from the worldly viewpoint. And so the teachings that begin to drive us and drive our actions and our motivations are from the worldly types of ideas and thinking, see, but not from a divine, truly divine system of thinking. So the capture system unfolds. We begin to be young adults, and we go into school, we get conditioned and educated there into systems of thinking. And any isms I've been designated as a system of thought, see. But these systems of thought begin to build up. They form eventually together. They form our worldview, see. It might be a very religious Christian view. It might be an agnostic view, an atheist view. It could be very, very detrimental satanic view or a Luciferian view or some secret society view. But anyway, we're subject to finally, we're not quite aware. We'll go back a second. As our worldview is being formed within us, and that we're subject to all the programming and conditioning and so forth, we're not fully aware that that's taking place, see. We're experiencing different people, different ideas, but we're not fully cognizant of and aware of the real totality of the influence that is taking place, see. We think that we're always thinking about the ideas and how they benefit us. But what I'm saying in my particular view, you could say, is that as we're coaxed, conditioned, mind-washed, programmed, and influenced into a certain way of thinking, okay, then that builds a false self, okay, because it's of the world, see. And you could say the ego, the false self, we sort of can use those sort of interchangeably, see. So, as an example here. But as we become young adults and become into adulthood, then we're not aware of the conditioned state or the deluded state is what I call it that has resulted from all of this living and conditioning and programming and so forth from our families and from our schools and our religions and our churches and so forth. So we're not awake, see. We're not fully awake. And we're conditioned into a worldview that's restricting us from becoming awake. Now, the reason why we do not ever awaken is that because we do not forgive. Because we will not forgive, then the fuel out there, you could say, of that the world system uses to control us is hate and resentment. See, non-forgiveness, non-loving ways is what drives most of us to consider ourselves better than, more knowledgeable than other people. See? And so when we think of ourselves as more knowledgeable, better, you know, than others or better than others, then we're flattering the ego, see? So we're flattering ourselves, see? When we flatter ourselves, it continues this deluded state and we can't break out of it. It's like a dog chasing its tail. The dog can't see that it's chasing its tail. So we're continually being programmed and ego reinforced, and the false self is being nurtured by hate and resentment and non-forgiveness systems of thinking and acting and being that we cannot come out of it. We do not see it because we're caught up in the field system that surrounds us. The light that bounces everywhere or is emanated everywhere begins to condition us through objects and other humans and ideas. We read on a page, that's light reflected from a printed words. The words begin to imprint us and they so forth. And so we're actually beginning to be programmed continuously from the worldly things. But my solution has always been, and we'll come up on the second hour in just about a minute and a half here, and I'll quit talking. But when you begin to forgive yourself and others, then you begin a system like geese flying home for the summer to their nesting grounds in Canada. You begin to do a homecoming back to that real self, which is conscience-based. In my book, Be Good to Yourself, which you can find on Amazon, okay, I talk about being good to yourself and others is like forgiving yourself and others. And when you truly forgive yourself and others, then you begin to dissolve that false self and this return back to the real core self, which is conscience-based, is somewhat achieved. Okay? And it's not something that you can just do overnight. It takes time. It takes a lot of time and trouble and work at it. So it's not easy. And I want to thank you for listening tonight. And anyway, David McRaney is coming up next. And listen carefully. We made some important points in talking to him. And he's really a fine person and put out some very, very good ideas. I want to thank each and every one of you, and I bless all of you. And let's just try to come out of this condition, you could say deluded state, and start trying to do the right thing by loving one another. And above all, let's start forgiving one another. And then we can come out of that conditioned state of slavery. Thank you for listening this evening.
And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield, and a warm welcome back to author David McRaney, who wrote the book, You Are Not So Smart. Ladies and gentlemen, go to youarenotsosmart.com. You can also get the book at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, iTunes, and Books A Million. Welcome back, David.
Hey, thank you.
Boy, you know, you have a quite a grasp for this. We were been talking, of course, off the air during the break and so forth. But you were talking about differing people with differing cultures and so forth. It gets very difficult for us to perceive this thing called reality in the same way, does it not?
Yeah, I would say that based off the last 50 or so years of research into neuroscience, psychology, and even things like behavioral economics, stuff like that, economic theory, that it's pretty evident from the science, the opinion of science is that we're pretty bad at determining objective reality. Like there is an objective reality out there, but human beings are limited by not only our senses, but also by the framework of the mind itself, the way it's built biologically and the way it organizes itself. There's something as simple as change blindness and inattentional blindness can point that out to us. We tend to believe that we're always getting all the information from the world into our minds through our eyeballs. 100% of the information is going in there, and we have this like perfect record of what's going on around us. But there's a study, and you can actually go on YouTube and find this. Just look up change blindness or inattentional blindness, and you can see where, for instance, they'll have people, they'll ask them to watch how many times they pass a basketball back and forth between a group of like five different people. And you're asked to count how many times they pass the basketball. And then at the end of about 2 minutes of this, you'll have a number, and then you'll write out the number, and you'll pass it to the researcher. And then they'll ask, okay, that really wasn't what the point of the study was. Did you recognize anything strange about the video? And usually about a third, sometimes up to a half of the people who watch it will go, no, I didn't see anything weird. And what they miss is that in the middle of that video, while people are passing the basketball around, a guy in a gorilla suit, or sometimes in a bear suit, has walked into the center of the frame, waved at the camera, and then walked back out again. And
well, that's cool.
And so about a third, or sometimes up to a half of the people who watch it, never see that, but that's not how we remember experiencing the world. We would, if we told someone that it happened to them, they would never believe us. They would never say that, because they're like, I was watching the whole time. And I think I would know if something like that happened, but yet we'd still rely on things like eyewitness testimony.
We still
look back on our lives as if we had have a perfect record of everything that's happened to us. But even right now, in the middle of this conversation or throughout your entire day, you have missed far more things than you've paid attention to. And the reality that we believe that we're experiencing is not the actual 100% one-to-one reality that's actually out there, not even amongst other people.
So yeah, eyewitness testimony, that was huge because, you know, people have been executed based on eyewitness testimony. And
Four
people watching a car accident will all give you four different renditions.
Exactly. That's what I write about in the book, and I go a little bit deeper into it. And if anyone wants to do their own research, you can just look up Elizabeth Loftus. She's the leading researcher into how faulty our memory is. And like you were saying, she did a study where they had people watch a car accident on a videotape, and then they asked them to estimate how fast the cars were going, but they would use a different word each time. They would say how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other. They would say how fast were the cars going when they bumped each other. And depending on the intensity of the verb, people would change their estimate of how fast the cars were going. But they, even creepier than that, they would have people watch a videotape of a robbery. And then they would sit them down with a book of mug shots and ask them to just thumb through and see if any of these mug shots seem familiar to you. And then they would put them let them watch a lineup. And 70 or so, it was something around 70% of the people would pick one of the people out of the lineup. But the person, and none of the people in the lineup were actually in the video. But they were in the book of mugshots. So the people were put in a situation where they were asked to pick someone out of the lineup. They searched their memory for anything that matched any of the people, and they remembered the mugshot. But when you go back one more level to the memory of the actual event, the person wasn't there. But they don't have a memory of that. They actually they reinterpreted their memory to match the situation they were in. So it's, depending on memory, is a very dangerous thing. And having this confidence in our perfect perceptions and our perfect logic is a really dangerous thing.
You know, David, I've gotten to the point now when I retell a story from my childhood or my past, I say, to the best of my memory and recollection, because I know I have altered some of my long-term memories.
I know that's true. And I can tell you that I've been in a situation where I've told a story at a party about something that happened to me, and I'll get about halfway through it, and one of my friends has said to me before, that didn't happen to you. I know it didn't happen to you because it happened to me. And so,
right.
You know,
that's pretty good, Dave.
I've stolen other people's stories and made them my stories.
Yes.
Hey, there's
because
some good ones out there.
But, David, is it not that our minds also, like when we're being told a story, we claim it. It becomes our own. And, you know, there's some sort of meshing of the psyche that goes on there that, yeah, you know, that, you know, someone tells you a really good story, it becomes your own. So I preface everything I say now about the past. I say, you know, to the best of my recollection or... Yeah,
that's why we have a written Constitution and Declaration of Independence. It's written writing, right?
Yeah, but you know, it's it can be interpreted any way you want. You know, that's the thing.
I love the word creator.
David,
what about the word creator in the Declaration of Independence? Right. For example, a Christian will see, you know, perhaps God. A Muslim perhaps will see Allah. An evolutionist perhaps will see Mother Earth. You know, an atheist will say, well, we'll see science. But that very word creator, we can all project our own, you know.
It's true. You know,
meaning.
We see the world through these rosy, filtered glasses of our own belief systems. And we interpret, and we have this weird tendency to think everyone else sees the world the way we see it. And when we get confronted with opposing viewpoints or with contradictory evidence, it throws us for such a loop. That it actually we physically change. You can, if you put someone in an MRI machine, and they actually look at a scan of their brain, and you present them with evidence that goes contrary to their belief system, you can actually watch the blood flow to the frontal cortex diminish. People's brains will actually shut down as if they're confronted with contradictory evidence or things that conflict with their belief systems, and we're built that way. And we don't completely understand why we do that. It probably falls into maintaining our self-esteem models, but we can predict that people will act that way.
Well, and I don't mean
it's to maintain that false self, that self-esteem model. That's it, isn't it?
Well,
I
that could
so.
Be. Yeah.
Okay,
well,
we've got to take a break here. Hey, we're
going
to open up the phones, 1-800-259-5791. And you can come back. Is that okay, David? Take some calls?
Sure.
Okay, 1-800-259-5791. We'll be right back.
Charlotte Littlefield, and a warm welcome back to David McRaney, blogger and author of You Are Not So Smart. Ladies and gentlemen, go to youarenotsosmart.com for a fascinating book. And David, you were over the break, you were talking a little bit about your thoughts about why people do argue online.
Something I wanted to mention, the research of a guy, of a psychologist, his name is Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T. And he's a brilliant, psychologist, brilliant researcher, and, he has a book coming out, I think, in a year or maybe 2 years from now. And his research is based off this idea of something he calls the moral matrix, in the sense that there's sort of this reality bubble that, is formed from the morality, bedrock that you stand on top of and that you see reality through, that it's difficult to accept that when another person sees the world so differently from you, it's so difficult to understand why. And he posits that it has to do with that they're fundamentally understanding the world from a different reality bubble than you are, based off of 5 moral sliders. And it gets complicated, but he asks questions like, would you be willing to clean a dirty toilet with an American flag? Now, for some people, you don't even have to think about it. Some people go, oh, that's terrible. That's how could you disgrace the flag and what it means and all this stuff. And then for some people, they're like, who cares? It's a piece of cloth. You know, the ideas are bigger than that. We shouldn't get caught up in worrying about symbols. We should worry more about this. And it's absolutely impossible for those two people to agree on that one thing. And there, he actually offers hundreds of examples like that. And those are the fundamental basis of how we see reality, and we can't get rid of them. We can't see them from any other direction. And so those things are also what determine what camp you fall into. Are you a liberal? Are you a conservative? Are you Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, whatever? That stuff is determined way back, way deeper. And, it has very little to do with your rational, logical, methodical exploration of the data. It has more to do with your gut, emotional response to things like fairness and authority, reciprocity, stuff like that. So I highly recommend looking into it, and I'm going to do a lot of research into that on my next project.
Right. You know, we're talking about brainwashing, mindwashing in many aspects of this, whether it's advertising or whatever, or political statements or whatever. How do you address those kinds of concepts and ideas?
Well, I'm from the standpoint of, people do most of the work. Like, you don't have to do very much work. People will follow and brainwash, quote unquote, themselves, through confirmation bias, backfire effect, hindsight bias, and other things. We're so keyed in on trying to maintain a high self-esteem, and we decide what that self-esteem model is based off of what we think keeps us maintaining a high status in our in-group. So let's say we feel that being moral is very important, or we feel that being attractive is very important, or we feel that being intellectual is very important. A person who believes that they are that they get social capital out of presenting themselves as being intelligent, is the kind of person who is going to be more likely to, build up their self-esteem through displays of their intelligence. So this is the kind of person who's going to be in the chess club. This kind of person who's going to take Latin. This kind of person who's going to, read, magazines and books that signal to other people that they're an intelligent person. So if you're going to market to that person, if you're going to try to persuade that person, then you will need to persuade them using tactics that play into that self-esteem, so that you will say, you should buy my product because smart people buy my product, and don't you want to be a smart person, you know, that kind of thing. And the weird thing about that is that's something that's been well understood by advertising for a long time, and that, you know, that's one of the techniques that they use to sell things to us. But in the modern era, they're actually trying something now where you can, as they when they identify you as the user of your computer or your smartphone or whatever, they are targeting ads at you, not just based off your past purchases. Say you're the kind of person who is, if you buy a tent, you might also be the kind of person who buys an axe. And you might also be the kind of person who needs to buy some survival gear and a backpack because you're obviously an outdoors person. But they will also go farther than that now. They will present to you a appeal to your emotions, and they'll try an ad that harkens back to when you camped out with your parents, and they'll try an ad that appeals to your intelligence, an ad that shows you this is the best equipment on the market, and so forth and so on, and they'll see what marketing technique works best on you, and they'll start using different techniques, not just showing you different products, based off the kind of things that are more likely to persuade you, and they'll actually build a persuasion model based off the kind of things you tend to fall for.
That's right. Complex.
It's crazy.
And I'm sure it's going to get even more complex the more we learn and the more they learn.
It's a never-ending arms race, definitely. And, you know, knowing yourself and knowing that that's how the how persuasion works is an important tool you need to have in your toolbox, I think.
Can we get to know ourselves, really?
A lot of what I write about, and I didn't really know that this was a major theory in psychology until I realized I had been writing about it for a while, but it's called self-perception theory. And it is there's a wing of psychology that many, many scientists are part of this wing of psychology, and many people are researching this today. There are researchers who are working on it. It says you really can't know yourself, that there's a certain level, there's a certain point where you go into the black box and you can't know anything beyond that point. And it's called self-perception theory. And it goes back to the beginning of psychology even, but the idea is that you observe your behaviors as if you were in an audience observing your behaviors. And since if you watch someone do something on stage, you really don't know why they're doing it. You know, if I look at someone across a restaurant and I see them doing something, I don't really know why they're doing it. But I come up with a theory, and I come up with a sort of a reasonable explanation for it that matches my observations in the past and so on. And that's what we do with ourselves. So let's say you were – a simple example would be, let's say that you were you see a cricket on your arm, and then you jump around and you wipe it off, and you freak out about it, and you scream, that later on you would assume that you have a fear of crickets because you're – looking at your behavior, and you're trying to explain it to yourself, and there might be something deeper behind that, not just crickets itself. That goes back to the sort of the Benjamin Franklin thing. People, they'll put pencils in their mouths, and there's a study where you can hold the pencil in your lips or hold it in your teeth. If you hold it in your lips, you kind of make a frown. If you hold it in your teeth, you kind of make a smile. And they show them pictures. They show them cartoons, comic strips. And if they're holding the pencil in their teeth and they're smiling, then they'll rate those comics as being funnier than the ones when they were holding them in their lips and they were frowning, because they're looking back on their own face and trying to explain why they were doing that. I guess I was doing that because I think it's funny. So, it's very difficult to understand yourself.
And listening to your thoughts, we can talk about that when we come back a little bit, how hard that is.
Or looking at your thoughts. Hey, we'll be back in just a few minutes here. Hang in there with us. And I have found my feet 257 weeks. You could be waiting for a day that won't come. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Bucker with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Welcome back to author and blogger David McRaney. Ladies and gentlemen, go to youarenotsosmart.com, the name of the book, and check it out. David, we have a call. We have a caller on the line. We have Travis from Texas. You're live on The Secret Truth.
Hi, David. Enjoying the conversation tonight. I look forward to checking out your book. I was curious to know if you have had much exposure to the Trivium education.
No, I'm not familiar with that. Could you tell me a little bit more about it?
Yeah, the classical seven liberal arts are comprised of what's called the Trivium and the Quadrivium, And the trivium is comprised of grammar, Aristotelian logic, and rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And what I find a lot of times in today is that people will put their logic in front of grammar, you know, rather than saying, you know, taking the time to research and learn the who, what, when, where of a subject, they automatically will jump to the why and will put logic in front of grammar. And that's okay. What the trivium is all about is pointing out where people, you know, have, they jump forward in their decision making.
Yeah. You know, a lot of, what you're talking about, you know, the long history of philosophy and just the philosophy of education, the philosophy of knowledge, in human culture, we've had thousands of years of this. We've only had 100 years or so of psychological research where we actually sat down, put this stuff in a lab, started getting data and, testing, retesting, and trying to actually quantify all this stuff. But a lot of the original thoughts go way back into the idea that, is this just a symbol for something that has a deeper meaning? How do we know this is the thing as it is? Or is this just the way that we're communicating this idea back and forth? The idea that we're so logical and rational and that we're not really depending on narratives is something that I try to keep coming back to. My favorite study that illustrates this, and this is a great example of something that, like what you're talking about, is an old idea, but it was put under a new lab condition to be researched, was there's a study where they had people, they had a department store with four different types of stockings, on display side by side and like on a fake leg. And they had people come in and they would have them, look at the four different types of stockings and touch them, look at them and everything, and then rate which one they thought was the best. And then after, hundreds of people come through there, they look at the results and they see that people basically always pick the one on the right. If there's 1, 2, 3, 4, they always pick 4. So they bring people in and they ask them, why did you pick 4? And they will say, well, it had the best texture. It had the best, I enjoyed the way it looked. It reminds me of the stockings that my mom used to buy. This is, I think it's just quality. They never mentioned that it's 4. And of course the great trick of the study is they're all the same stocking. So people, when they're tasked with coming up with a reason for why they do what they do, when they're tasked with coming up with an explanation for their own behavior, with an explanation for their own self, they'll do it. And that we're always forming those narratives. We're always forming those stories about who we are, why we are, and what we think. And as evidenced in that study and many others, it's oftentimes just simply a confabulation. It's just a nice embellishment of the truth that helps us move forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, very cool. Well, I'm going to get a copy of your book, and I would also encourage you to check out the Trivium Education.
I'll do it. Sounds great, man.
All right. Take it easy.
Thank you, Travis, for your call. We appreciate you calling in.
Good deal.
Classical education, the closing of the American mind seemed to come pop up in my head, where the classics and the old liberal arts degrees and so forth, are they emphasized as much as they used to be, or are they just not really in anymore?
Well, the worst thing that ever happened to education in America is rigorous testing and No Child Left Behind. The reason for that is there's so much, when it comes to being a well-rounded, educated person who knows how to think, knows how to teach yourself, knows how to research, a lot of that stuff can't be quantified very well. And if it can't be parsed out into charts and graphs like math and certain types of science reasoning can be, then it doesn't get put into the curriculum because it can't be tested for. So it's very difficult to see if someone understands what are the moral, philosophical and and underpinnings of a story like Frankenstein, or a story like Of Mice and Men, and then try to compare and contrast that with modern life and your personal life. Those are things that are very difficult to test on a multiple choice basis and run through a Scantron. And so therefore those things have been really de-emphasized in modern education, at least in modern American education. And that's really terrible. And so, yeah, there's been a lot of de-emphasis on arts, a lot of de-emphasis on literature, and a lot of de-emphasis on certain types of critical science reasoning and education, because it's just difficult to test for it. And until we kind of get that hammered out, we're going to probably go through a weird period of time in education.
Right. There are some people that say we're just creating workers for the corporations. That's all. And our schooling system. But I don't think they're that well-schooled anymore, even for that, are they?
It's... I don't know for sure, but I can tell you just anecdotally that it feels that way for sure.
Right. We've had Charlotte Isserby on our program several times, and she really was in the education department, U.S., you know, federal and all that, and she's written some very fine things on education. And she seemed to get back to the Prussian model that we lifted from Prussia, which was a nationalistic model that created a citizen soldier. Say.
Well, you
and
can't have.
Go ahead.
I am one of those people. I'm in that camp that believes that you can't have a functioning society unless everybody is really well educated, and not just and certainly not just facts, but with the idea that that, like I write about in the book, something called the Dunning-Kruger effect, and that is, the less you know about something, the less you believe there is to know about something. It's that thing where somebody goes from being a novice to an amateur, and they think that only took a couple months. So to become a master is probably only going to take a couple more months. So let's say you're learning how to play guitar. You pick it up, and it's very difficult. It makes no sense. But after a couple of weeks, you're able to play a song, and you're like, wow, that's pretty easy. I guess I can be, Kirk Hammett or Carlos Santana in just a couple of months. But that same weird way of thinking about the world plays into whether or not you feel educated about a subject. So somebody who reads a couple of Wikipedia entries on climate science, or reads a couple of Wikipedia entries on the founding fathers, or whatever it is that you're reading, it's when you go from novice to amateur in your education, you start to get that false concept that the people out there who we consider the experts are people who've just researched for a little bit more than you have, not people who've devoted their entire life to it. And it's a weird, weird way to see the world that is, I'm seeing more and more prevalent in modern society.
Yeah, and literature has become a burden, frankly, because of the pace of what they've got the children doing. The kids, some of them get up, they start basketball practice at 6:30 in the morning, and they may have a game or some other quiz bowl or Science Olympiad or some other obligation that evening. The child won't return home until 9 or later in the evening, and in that whole day they didn't get to read anything they wanted to read. They had to read what was presented to them and was required.
Yeah.
So when I say a lack of literature, it's just there's actually no time.
It's true.
You
can
read Charles Dickens, those kinds of novels and books, they matter nothing.
Yeah, every teenager should read Catcher in the Rye and realize, hey, guess what? Somebody thought this 40 years ago, and they should realize. It's a good thing to know that people have had the thoughts that you're having at the same time you've had them all throughout history.
Our Great Expectations was a wonderful book, too. Hey, we'll be right back. Thanks for being with us, David. Nobody on the road. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with...
Yeah.
How is it that you were able to attract so many people?
I'm a believer, and I'm somebody who's... I've worked in journalism for a number of years, and I'm working in new media now, and I noticed that there's a trend. There's this danger when you get to pick all the news sources that you pull from, when you get to pick all the books and magazines and... that you read from, that you can become ensconced in this alternate reality that's based off of whatever the reality was that you brought to the table, and you're never challenged. And I think that the only way to have epiphanies, the only way to grow as a human being is to constantly be challenged, to constantly ask yourself, am I on the right path? Do I have more to learn about the world? And so I tried to create this project as something that from the very second you see the title of it, you're challenged. You're immediately put into a position where you're having to defend your beliefs, and then you read everything from that perspective, and you're open to the idea that maybe you've got something to learn. Maybe you're deluded in some way.
Yeah, you're right about being challenged. We do have another caller, Richard from Texas. What's your question for David McRaney?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I had a real quick question. Last week it was announced that 539 clergy all decided to go against the 501c3, and they challenged it using the Constitution saying that they would go with freedom of religion, freedom of speech, and freedom of assembly. And it's been said that a lot of these clergy do not want to get out of the 501c3, but they still want the advantage of standing in the pulpit. So my question is, is there some kind of self-aggrandizing, some type of ego thing going on that's not being focused on with all these clergy that won't get out of the 501c3, but they're taking advantage of their position as being community leaders? In other words, I'm asking, can you break down their psychology collectively? Because there's got to be something going on where these people won't do what God has called them to do, and that is speak against evil. And I'll leave it right there, and I'll take your answer off here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
This is just an educated guess, or maybe it's just a guess, but I would say that whenever you move from individual to an organization, whenever you start thinking about things in terms of institutions, institutions have their own way of going about things. The institution is always trying to survive. The institution is almost like an insect or a simple animal, and it wants to survive to the next generation by any means necessary. And the members of that organization are going to work toward that goal. So in this specific instance, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but I know that if the survival of the entity might require a little bit of that entity going against its original conditions for forming, it might be considered something that is a risk worth taking for the greater good of surviving into the next generation.
Right. Would it be cognitive dissonance of an organization then, but translated by through individuals, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're just people have a really amazing ability to justify their actions and come up with a reason for what they're doing that is, it's the whole, you know, would you steal bread to feed your starving children? You know, like, so, on any other day, you would say stealing bread is wrong, but in that instance, you can come up with a justification for it. And task with a reason, with a need for a justification, we will come up with it. And especially if we've got a group of people together who are all sharing, shared interests. That justification can be act of coming up with a justification can be greatly enhanced, and it'd be difficult for those people to see outside of that.
Yeah, the 501c corporation, which is the church in America today, you know, I mean, right, that gives them their tax exempt status. To have such a large number of people step away from that is signaling to the group something's wrong, doesn't it? Wouldn't you say that they're trying to initiate a signal to the group that says,
I think they want freedom for that group of people to express whatever they want, political, religious, or whatever.
Well, theoretically, aren't you supposed to have that, even if you are a 501c or whatever? But to break away from the group benefit of the tax relief, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not completely familiar with that situation, but I would... I totally understand the concept that if you feel that your freedom to express yourself is being limited by some sort of weird standard that's being placed on you by the culture, then I could totally understand trying to step out of those boundaries.
Yeah, that's what the government is doing is trying to limit the church to keep them away from political thought and pronouncements and activities. That's what they're doing.
Oh, I think it's just the opposite. I think people get their politics from the pulpit.
Well, I mean, you should get your politics from wherever, you know, but you should be able to freely walk in and out of these organizations.
Sure. We get our politics from a deep, my theory is that we get our politics from an even deeper source, and then we move out into our public lives trying to justify that political viewpoint. You know, I think that most people know exactly who they're going to vote for president, you know, months and months in advance. And then, you know, they watch all the debates and they read all the news stories, in a certain way, not to gain more information, but to try to justify the choice they've already made. They're trying to, they've already,
Select just a few little tidbits that provide a support for their reelecting someone or something, right?
Yeah, I think that it's much more about confirming the way you feel instead of trying to seek out new information. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't want to be challenged because you know, they know it. They're real smart, right? But we all think we're real smart.
Yeah, we're all there's the average person believes they are not. That's the truth. We're all smarter than the average person. We're all better drivers than the average person. We all are we're more talented, better looking.
David, I am definitely the better driver than the average person.
Yeah, and if we're all better drivers,
she drives all over the yard, than anybody.
If we're all better drivers than the average person, then who is the average person?
Yeah. Well, no, those are the ones that have their wrecks, the average person. I'm better than that.
Right.
Well, you know, I've always noticed.
So I might be average, too.
I've noticed there's this self-centeredness that we as human beings, it's like a part of our being in the mammalian body, you know? It's like, and I refuse to hold it against people that they are self-centered.
Yeah,
I think it's a survival instinct of the reptilian portion of the brain or the R complex. I don't know.
Yeah, you have to have a healthy dose of self-delusion to get out of bed in the morning. I mean, the best is, all the things I write about serve us well in the best of circumstances, but we're just not always in the best of circumstances. I think that we can work to change, and we should, but change is slow going. And I guess my thesis is that in the meantime, let's admit to our faults, and let's try to stop making policies and laws and decisions in our personal lives that assume that we're rational and logical beings. And we instead, let's look at how science has predicted our flawed reasoning and use that to outsmart our future selves. Let's sort of childproof our lives the same way we would childproof our home. You know, you don't walk up to a small child and try to explain to them why they shouldn't do things and then expect them to just take that in and do what you say. You also put, you know, a fence around the pool, and you put covers over the light sockets and stuff like that, over the power outlets and everything, because you were trying to childproof them against their own predictable bad behaviors. Well, we have also predictable stumbling blocks, predictable biases, predictable bad behaviors, and we can actually outsmart our future selves in the same way. You know, we know we're going to procrastinate. We know that teenagers are not going to abstain from sex. We know people are not going to save for retirement. So we can actually set up a world that takes all that stuff into account.
Well, I think we'll talk about that tomorrow, about procrastination. You want to do that?
Yeah, let's put it off till next week.
I think that's a good time to talk about procrastination tomorrow sometime.
David, it was a pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Thank
I learned a
much.
Lot. Thank you.
David, I really do appreciate and I feel honored to have you this evening, and we certainly appreciate your time spent with us.
Hey, it was my pleasure. Thanks a bunch.
Okay, David. David McRaney. You're not so smart.
.com. Thank
Charles,
you, George.
Thank you up there. Our engineering was great, as usual. You did a wonderful job. And you had a couple of fine callers coming in.
And thank you to the listening audience.
That's about it.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. See you next week.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. See you next week. Bye-bye.